You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning, everyone. We need a good morning back. At Brookings, we've been trying to have our morning meetings a little bit later so that you're more awake, but we are constrained by whatever rooms we can get. And for Professor Dave Kong, we wanted to have a larger room, so we are here at 9 o'clock sharp. People will be coming in, so don't be distracted. My name is Kathy Moon from the Center for East Asia Policy Studies at Brookings, and I'm very, very happy to introduce two special people to you. These are two friends, really, not only colleagues. I've known them for a very, very long time, and Dave Kong in particular I've known for a long time since we were little kids, young professors starting out in our career. David Kong is going to speak to us today about the, quote, so-called arms race in East Asia and challenge constructively and creatively some of the conventional views and assumptions that people have about China's rise and the impact, military and political impact on East Asia. Those of you who are familiar with David's work, you know that he is never boring. He is always intellectually innovative and challenging and creative, and he doesn't like to take the accepted wisdom and lazily sit with it. He's getting all embarrassed now. He pushes the envelope to force us all to think more clearly, think more creatively, and that is what he will do today. David has many hats. I'll just name a few, and you can read his bio that we have written up for you. He is a professor of international relations and business at the University of Southern California. He also heads the Korea Studies Institute there, has a very active program. He also is the USC director of the USC Center for International Studies. And he is a very, very active mentor of students, undergrads as well as graduate students, and a very wonderful colleague. He's written several books. Many of you have read them. His latest ones refer to East Asia, The Rise of China. They're both by Columbia University Press. And most importantly, you will just have the benefit of hearing him in his own words. Rebecca Patterson will be our discussant. Rebecca was my research assistant over a decade ago, and I'm very, very happy to share with you her newest position. She works in the State Department in the Office of Peacekeeping, Sanctions, and Counterterrorism in the Bureau of International Organizational Affairs. She is an active duty lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army. She is a West Point graduate, a PhD from George Washington University in National Security Studies, a big powerhouse of a mind and a wonderful personality, and I think the two of them together will offer us a really interesting program. So, Dave.
Now, the one thing... There we go. Okay, it's going to come up with the... With the things there. All right. Well, thank you, Kathy. Thank you for having me. Thank you, everybody, for coming out at 9 in the morning. I'm getting over jet lag, so hopefully this will work well. And I want to start out by saying I hope it's not going to be too unconventional, because I think it's actually fairly conventional. But I do think that actually the debate over China is actually quite stale. And so I decided to put it on a slide. Threat or opportunity, all of the arguments that we've heard... We've heard for a generation. So a good friend of mine, Aaron Friedberg, in 1993, ripe for rivalry. 25 years later, ripe for rivalry. He may be right at some point. He's made an entire career predicting that the rise of China will cause instability and war. He may eventually be right. Increasingly, we have a view that the region's getting more unstable. Our good president is out there right now in the Philippines standing on a warship. looking tough, racing towards tragedy. And these are, you know, you may know these names or not, but these are some of the top thinkers about China that we have in academia. Avery Goldstein, China's Real and Present Danger, John Eikenberry, the mighty Eikenberry. And then, of course, we have what I consider to be some of the laziest use of analogies, which is using European history and slapping it on Asia. I have a whole subset of things about that, right? I just find it very lazy. We don't know anything about Asia, but we do know something about Europe. So we'll say something happened in Europe, so therefore it'll happen in Asia 100 years ago. Wait, no, 2,000 years ago, somewhere in Greece, somebody fought. Therefore, that's going to happen today. May or may not be right, but I don't see really any relevance of these kinds of analogies for what's going on. Why don't we use Asian history to learn about Asia? But anyway, the point is I think a lot of this is stale. The number of times I see Thucydides referenced or 1914 referenced or the rise of the blah, 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 and I think it's stale. And I think it's stale particularly because we're now into the point where we are creating an echo chamber, that's a bad choice of words, where we all believe ourselves. So now, Fords, everybody, the arms race, right? So I'm going to say that this is the thing. I think Korea is the canary in the coal mine. And I think there are two things that are going on in East Asia that we tend to view separately, but actually are deeply interlinked. And what I mean is this. There's the U.S., China, all this kind of stuff we're trying to figure out. But it is very stale. And I'm not making a self-interested argument here. But I think that viewing the region from the perspective of Korea gives us purchase on what's going on in a way that I think provides a lot of insight and is worth considering. And that's why I call it a canary in the coal mine, because it's sort of a warning sign. And the warning sign is this, which doesn't mean that Korea loves China and doesn't like the United States. But we have to explain this. We have to explain what's going on. And why I say they're two separate things is this. We talk about U.S., China, and all the arms race and everything else. And then we see Korea doing what Korea does, which is very, very, very close relations with the United States and good relations with China. And we say, oh, well, they just need to whatever, those Koreans, et cetera. And we are not taking as seriously as we should what Korea is telling us about the way regional countries view what's going on. So this is going to be a generic talk about East Asia, but I'm going to come back to Korea because I think Korea is extremely important in this. For a number of reasons, understanding Korea and taking it seriously will give us a lot of purchase on U.S.-China dynamics and what's going to happen in the future. So I'm going to start out with this. I'm going to do a couple things, right? My main point is this. All the countries in the region, states, countries in the region, have their own interests. They share many of those with the United States, but not all. And I don't think, I mean, in some ways it seems obvious, right? We ought to be ready for countries that share some, but not all of our interests. And I don't think it's wise to build U.S. policy trying to get the countries to share our interests completely. Because I don't think it's ever going to happen. And that's why I think Korea is a canary in the coal. It tells us about how the United States needs to think about the region and what is going on. So I'm going to talk about the regional power transition briefly because it's worth remembering how these countries view their situation. And then I'll do the arms race stuff and I'll talk about the United States and then conclude with Korea. Right? And this is sometimes interesting, but this regional power transition here I have to say that the just wait, I'm picking on Aaron Friedberg, but he's a big shot. He's a much bigger shot than me, so I can pick on him. Just wait. Yeah, it wasn't, okay, 1993, what didn't really happen. But just wait, it'll happen. 2000. Now, just wait a couple more years. By now, I'm through saying just wait. Because the transition is over. There is no more just wait in the region. So here we have the percentage of GDP, right, over 25 years. And I took 11 countries. I think they're out of order, right? Here's Japan's share of regional GDP of 11 countries over 25 years. In 1988, at the height of the Japanese bubble, okay, it doesn't work, 70% of regional GDP. Japan was massive. Now it's about 25% of regional GDP. And of course, you know it's coming, but it's worth looking at it. This is China's share of regional GDP. In 1988, it was less than 10% of the region's the size of the economy. Trade, and here's the countries now for trade. Trade is the same thing. These are the countries that are included in this slide. These lines have crossed. The only question is how much bigger that gap is going to get. We can all talk about the Chinese economy and is going to fail or not. The Chinese economy can fail and it will still be bigger than everybody else. And there's another way I'd like to show this, just to remind us of what China's role in the region is this. There's other ways to look at the size of countries. So I have land mass down below, land mass in 1,000 square kilometers. And then on the other side of population in millions. And what you see is a sort of multipolar East Asia. Japan, Philippines, Vietnam, Thailand, Singapore. But obviously, I'm missing one country. Right? This is a bait and switch. You cannot put them on the same scale. Everybody gets squished down. That is how big China is. And the countries in the region are going to live with China one way or another. So it's worth keeping in mind that the regional power transition is done. There is no more just wait. China can have a 50% collapse of its economy, which it won't, by the way. You heard it here first. And it'll still be bigger and more central than every other country in the region. And that's a reality that the other countries in the region have to live with. Because, as Koreans know, they're not moving away. And so that's the starting point for when we try and think about what is going on, what are the regional dynamics. And here what I did, and I've been doing this for a while, because I wrote some stuff in the early 2000s. I wrote a piece basically arguing we shouldn't use Europe to explain Asia, etc., about in 2003. And I like to joke about it, but the amount of skepticism I faced, right? Just wait, you never know. You never know. Mistakes can happen, right? We're now 12 years later. And what I started to do is I started to watch one thing at the time. Literally at the time, I started to watch military expenditures. Because the argument is the bigger that China gets, the more everyone will be afraid, and the more they'll start to arm. Very straightforward argument. So I watched, and for a couple years, I thought, who knows, a couple years, just wait. You never know. I waited. By now, a couple years ago, I started to publish it because I've waited long enough. It's time to publish. And what I did particularly is I took East Asia and I compared it to Latin America, another region that we think is far more stable and less dangerous than East Asia. So I think this really gives us a nice comparison of what's going on in these two regions. But let's first take East Asia by itself. This is what we expect to see. 1988, whatever, 2014, right? Now, if we look at constant, I'm going to show you a bunch of slides. I'm happy to explain them all in more detail. This is DC, so I'm not worried about it. But this is constant inflation-adjusted dollars. This is spending over 25 years. So one country, here's our expectation. One country fits that model, the expectation. That's China. I will also tell you, you're going to see another slide later on, China's share of its economy is going down. As the share of an economy, it's going down because China's growing so fast. This doesn't tell us anything we don't know. Here is what is interesting. One of these doesn't look like the others. Green is Japan. This is Japan. Essentially flat for the last 20 years. And I will point out, for those of you who do know Japan, Abe, who is widely considered blah, 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 the most nationalist, etc., if the economy goes the way he wants it to, and if he survives for 5 years, it will be a 5% increase in real terms. It's not a remilitarization, what Japan is trying to do. It is not a remilitarization. It's 5% in real terms. Everybody else is flat. You don't see any response. Now I'm going to do something else, which is, keep going, Australia, right? Costly signals, ignore the IR jargon, right? Now what I decided to do, and I actually like this slide better. It's a percentage of GDP, the share of the economy. And I like this better because this measure reflects the decisions that a country makes every year. usually in the Capitol, every bureaucracy gets together and has a big fight over their share of the budget. And in the history of the world, not a single time has a bureaucracy said, we have too much money, here you take some. We need less. Right? That has never happened. So the proportion of the economy that a country decides to devote to its military reflects its domestic priorities. That's why I think the share of GDP tells us the same story, but in a way more interesting way. So, this is Latin America, and the countries are down. I took like 10 of them. Argentina, Bolivia, Chile, Colombia, Mexico, etc. What you can see is in the Cold War, 2.5% of the economy. Basically still the same. Now it's trended down. It's the average is about 1.8% of the economy. So there's been a contraction after the Cold War, but it looks roughly stable. The red line is East Asia, and again, the basket of countries is Japan, China, South Korea, Taiwan, Vietnam, etc. Now, this one chart tells you everything that my talk is about. After that, we're just discussing the implications of it. And I'm going to show you other charts, because I have sliced and diced these data and other data in every single way I can, and it all affirms this chart, which is this. During the Cold War, East Asian countries spent roughly half more than Latin American countries of their economies. So during the Cold War, these countries averaged 3.5%. But what you notice is after the Cold War, those lines roughly converge by about 2000. So that both regions now average under 2% of their economy. In other words, that is almost a 50% contraction on average in East Asia on defense spending. In other words, countries are saying, over time, over a generation, every single year. Well, this year the military gets a little bit less of the share of the budget. Just a little bit less this year. And this is why I think it is so compelling. And I know I'm going a little bit long, but I want to make this point because I think it's an important point. To do the just wait, I can understand maybe once a couple years they don't realize China's growing. You never know. They might have a stumble. It's 1988. There's Tiananmen. We have a lefty government that doesn't want to spend on military. 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. We're approaching 30 years that governments have consistently prioritized other things over the military. I'll show you a couple more, and then I'll get on to what I think this tells us. The trend line, the only thing that matters here is I looked much more recently, because maybe 25 years is too much. The red is the trend line in spending in Latin America. The blue is the trend line. The trend is larger in Latin America than in East Asia. I'll show you one more, because this is interesting. Maybe it's economic growth. So we have the average economic growth in East Asia, average economic growth in Latin America. Growth in East Asia much higher. Even if you take out China, it's much higher average growth in East Asia than Latin America. The military expenditures, even including China, are lower than they are in Latin America. So it's not simply, oh, East Asia is growing richer, therefore they're able to devote less of a proportion. They're growing richer, but they're spending less, and Latin America is spending more. And we ignore these. I'm going to do this very briefly. Naval. These are principal surface combatants in Latin America and East Asia. So I've sliced it at this level too, 2015. Now you'll notice the two countries most deeply involved in the maritime territorial dispute with China are the Philippines and Vietnam. The only country they have more principal surface combatants than is Bolivia. Bolivia shockingly has zero. You guys are a tough crowd, man. This is D.C. Wow. Or more, there's coffee in the back, right? But I mean, Malaysia, Peru, Chile, right? There are a lot of countries that have, for normal reasons that we would expect, have 6, 8, 10, a couple destroyers, a couple frigates, whatever else, right? The Philippines and Vietnam over a generation have decided no. Right now they're getting two of our cannons. They're getting a Coast Guard and a research ship from the United Philippines is. Yes, this is the Philippine Navy. And I'm not making this up. This is a 1942 American destroyer. That is this. They have two right now. This is one of them. It was decommissioned by the United States in 1955 and given to Japan, and decommissioned from Japan in 1975 and given to the Philippines. That is their Navy. It should be in a museum, and that's not a joke. It is a relic from World War II. And that's okay. There's plenty of domestic politics reasons why the Philippines has not chosen to prioritize military spending on naval purchases to defend their maritime claims. That's the point. Is there's a lot of talk, and we're going to get to what they hope the United States will do for them. But over a generation, they have not chosen to make those decisions, to prioritize it themselves. And we need to face that. So that brings us right nicely to the United States. And the question is, in many ways, the obvious explanation for all of this is, well, they're expecting the United States to defend them so they don't have to. We hear this all the time. And in a way, I think it's probably true. If it is true, we really need to think about what we're doing. I'm not so sure it's as true as we think it is. And my point there is what I'm calling a tipping point, meaning the idea is that at some point, if the U.S. pulls back or if the U.S. is not as involved, there will be a tipping point and they will step up and do it themselves. We are the cork in the bottle, whatever, so that if we pull out, eventually there will be enough fear and they will all start arming and fighting with each other. I'm not so convinced there's a tipping point. If there is, it's a much lower tipping point than we think, or higher, or whatever it is. Let me show you what I mean. You guys get the argument. You've heard this argument all the time, right? It's U.S. defense, umbrella, et cetera, right? The question is, if the U.S. weren't there, would the region be more unstable? Well, what we know is that the U.S. pivot started out 5 years ago, aimed at prioritizing economics, diplomacy first, economics second, and the military third. I actually think Obama got it right. I think the region wants a lot of stuff from the U.S., military being one of the weakest or the lowest priority. After 5 years, we're down to the rebalance essentially being some troops in Darwin and a couple of ships to the Philippines. And this other stuff is really deprioritized. But we did that in part because of our military was overstretched and tired from other places. We did it in part because even in East Asia, the U.S. presence has decreased dramatically over a generation, which we tend to forget, which is why I talk about the tipping point. So we had 500,000 troops in 1970, obviously, height of the Vietnam War. By 1990, 100,000 troops. Now we're down to 67,000 troops. So we're a 90% reduction in boots on the ground in East Asia. That's how much, you know, you have to go pretty far. If there's no tipping point, it's that. Well, maybe it's not troops on the ground, boots on the ground. Here's our naval deployments over a generation. 101 surface combatants, again, height of the Cold War, 8 carriers. So we're at a third reduction in aircraft carriers, 50% reduction in principal surface combatants, etc., right? Submarines are still the same. There's still no question the United States military is the most powerful military in the world. There's no question. But it does lead to what I think is the real interesting question is, how low would those numbers have to go? If 50% doesn't, if 90% of troops and 50% of surface combatants doesn't prompt any response in East Asia, it's a pretty low tipping point. There's an alternative explanation. Okay, so here's the last thing. And this is another key slide, because we often take East Asia as just a lump, a group. But we really have two types here. And particularly with maritime disputes, with the role of the United States, there's a huge difference between Philippines and Vietnam. We cannot lump them together. It is very clear that if a real war broke out, we'd probably side on the side of the Philippines. I sincerely doubt any Vietnamese military leader thinks that we would intervene if they got in a war with China. It's different. We have allies, we have non-allies. We have treaty allies, and we don't. So if the United States umbrella is what is causing certain countries to feel safe and not defend themselves, then the lack of an umbrella ought to mean that there's a difference, that those who don't have the umbrella, who don't have the assurance, like Vietnam, ought to be spending more. Because they can't really trust the United States. And they would be really naive. No, I mean, honestly, just put yourself in the, anyone in Vietnam. How naive would you have to be to think, okay, I can pick a fight with China because the U.S. will, they're right up my back. Right? That's not happening. So you, if they're worried, and that's the key thing, if they're worried, there ought to be a difference. So I divided the two countries. We have allies in red and non-allies in blue of the United States. Non-allies and allies. Now, during the Cold War, this again totally fits my argument. Wow, shocking. No, right? The blue line is not, the red is the allies. During the Cold War, they spent about half of what non-allies spent on their militaries, if you divide it out. And it makes sense. During the Cold War, we really were defending Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, etc. And countries who didn't have a U.S. defense umbrella were much more insecure. If you go back to the 70s and 80s, Indonesia, Malaysia, etc., etc. What is amazing is how those lines cross again within a decade or so. Now, both of them are below 2%. For the last 15 years, they've roughly been identical. You can do statistical things on this, and there's no a t-test. There's no statistical difference between these two. You can just look at it. The lines are basically identical. This is really interesting. There is no difference between the way allies act and the way non-allies act in their military spending. So what is the role of the United States then if we're the thing? Some should be much more safe than others. Whew, I can free ride on the U.S. We won't waste our money. The U.S. will do it for us. But then other countries who don't have a U.S. military alliance are spending the same amount. My rough conclusion of all of this is there's no arms race. No matter how I judge it, no matter how I slice it, no matter whether you measure naval deployments, submarine, you cannot find an arms race. By a technical definition we use among the eggheads, which is 8% a year, blah, 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 with an identifiable enemy. Or just in general, it's obvious the spending is down, not up. And I, again, if 5 years maybe, 10 years maybe, we're talking about 25, 30 years. I think we have to take it seriously. Something else is going on. And I'm going to use Korea now as the view from Korea because it shares some but not all American priorities. Which is this. We don't like it. I know every time we talk about this, everyone starts laughing. Oh, those crazy Koreans. But in a way, we have to take it seriously. Korea and China share a number of concerns that the United States does not necessarily share. And we are not going to change Koreans' minds. Believe me, I've spent a generation myself writing op-eds in Korean newspapers saying, why do you care what Japan thinks? Nobody listens to me. I'm just a professor, right? Like, we're not, they care. They share priorities. They share concerns. I'm not saying you should or shouldn't. But rather than wish that Korea became different, we need to understand they view the strategic region different than we do, the strategic landscape differently than we do. I'm not, and everybody who knows Korea knows I am not cherry picking these. These are the most consistent results over and over and over again. Ready? You can go back 50 years, 30 years, next year, they will do the same thing. They view Japan as a threat. And what's so funny is they view it as a military threat. And you're like, really? But they do. And we have to take it seriously. They do not share the same threats. And this is actually more interesting. A third of Koreans, but two-thirds of Japanese, view China as a military threat. Sorry, it's a bit low. I'll read it. This is actually more interesting, and I think this is hilarious. So, again, I am not everybody who knows Korea knows I'm not cherry-picking these numbers. These are incredibly consistent. So, favorability on a scale of 1 to 7. USA, 6. Xi Jinping, 5. Japan and North Korea, identical. I'm not cherry picking. You can go with Abe and Xi Jinping or whatever. Koreans don't love China, but they know how to live with it, and they don't view it as a threat the way that we do. And I'm not cherry picking Korea. We should not expect that a Korea views the disputes the same way that we do. Japan might. Japan is a different country. Japan, I think, pretty clearly likes being, you know, partner with the U.S., et cetera, et cetera. They're happy to choose sides. But I'll talk about this in a minute, right, that I think it's a little bit more complex as we start to go around the region. Malaysia, Thailand, Indonesia, Vietnam. I was in Vietnam for a week last year, talking to everyone I could about China-U.S. relations. Fascinating things. They don't necessarily like being pushed around by China. Number two, many of the Vietnamese get their knowledge about China in the English language press. Points for us, we need more PR. It's really hilarious. I got to speak Chinese. Right? But they're also like, we have to live with this country, and we're going to try not to have to pick a fight if we don't have to. We all know, and this was the thing that came out very, very clearly, right? Let me see if I get there right. One of the key distinctions, which I'm going to conclude, oh, I'll conclude with it later, right? The other thing is this, right? Even within the countries that are closest allies, there are these issues that we know. There's domestic politics. And again, I think if we put rise of China over here and then, oh, just a bunch of NIMBY Okinawans over there, I think we're missing the larger picture, which is that this isn't a Cold War, and I don't think it's going to be a Cold War. And this is finally, this is absolute spend. It's constant dollars just over the last 10 years or 15 years of regional things, right? We have allies. We have non-allies. You see no reaction. There is no reaction from these countries. And that shouldn't be a percent sign. That's billions. So in billion dollars, right? Japan, inflation adjusted, about $60 billion. Vietnam and the Philippines, about $4 billion. Everything is flat. So my conclusion is there is no tipping point. And what do I mean by that is only two countries fear for their survival. And if we go back to basic IR, in a way I'm not surprised. Because one of the key things about the maritime disputes in the South China Seas, which I'll talk about just briefly, is this. Very interesting. You read a lot of the IR literature, and poli-sci, maybe you guys are all, not very few of you look like college students anymore. But like, you know, it's always like, well, if I give in now, then maybe he'll end up conquering all of me. It's only two countries fear for their survival. North Korea and Taiwan. It's unthinkable. Nobody thinks China wants to be, again, like Japan 100 years ago and just go through everybody's heartland and make it all into it. No. Right? So, yes, there might be a dispute over where the border is, but only two countries fear for their survival. So I'm not surprised that national military spending is at levels which are basically my national survival is not threatened. Border control, maritime, piracy, these types of issues. If you think that military spending is a function of national survival, I'm not surprised. Right? Furthermore, they all have to live, as we know, with China. We know this. And at our peril, we ignore the dissatisfaction with American-led IMF in East Asia. We're getting on 20 years from the Asian financial crisis, and I still know that there is a difference in the way almost every East Asian country views the role of the U.S. and the IMF during the financial crisis and the way we view it. We still think, we did it wrong. We saved you guys. And there is still resentment. We don't have to like it. But there is welcome for alternative economic institutions. So, number one, East Asia is not multipolar. I don't think it ever will be multipolar. It is wishful thinking to hope it's going to be multipolar. It's not. The region is unipolar with China. It might be bipolar with the United States. But it's not going to be multipolar. I don't see how that's happening, right? I think we got to conclude empirically there's no regional arms race. Which means I don't think there's a nascent balancing coalition against China. I can't see how a Korea would join that, a containment coalition against China. Maybe the Philippines, maybe. Although, I should have put this in. The Pew Attitude World Survey poll from July of this year, 57% of Filipinos have a positive view of China. Right? I mean, let's not get carried away with how much they're mad at China. It's over 50%, right? Malaysia. These are not, you know, we our balancing coalition is sort of Japan and maybe one or two other countries. This is not a containment coalition. All the states in the region, and again, have to live with China. And again, they have some of our interests, but not all. And I want to conclude, and then I'm going to say what I think this means for U.S. foreign policy. There is a chance for misperception. The more that we, I'll come back to this, right? The more that the United States, and this is where I think it's important for the people in this room, right? We may decide for our own interests that we're going to fight with China over stuff. But it's pretty clear those other countries are not going to do it. So the only way a war is starting is if we decide and China decides that we're going to do it. And that's probably through misperception, as we know. You know, freedom of navigation, blah, blah, blah. We're going to go nose to nose. We can do all that stuff if we decide to. I find that ironic. I spent 30 years telling East Asian countries those rocks don't matter. Oh, wait, no, yes, they do matter. But I will tell you this. It's interesting when we look at it. I'm not even convinced that we can sustain some kind of a China threat in the United States. Why? Number one. If you compare to the Soviet Union, China poses no political threat. They clearly do not have vast imperial goals the way the Soviet Union did. Number two, they pose no economic threat. Communism, you know, socialism, communism was a direct alternative to capitalism. There is no alternative now. China is getting rich by buying in. Right? So what is the thing? If it's not about power and if it's not about wealth, the one thing, and it can be, this actually could be very dangerous, though, is that it could be about status. Who's number one? Primacy. That, I think, we're not quite, we have a real decision of, can we live with a big China? Because they're used to thinking of themselves as a civilizational power. We're used to thinking of ourselves as a civilizational power. I don't think it's about this other stuff. It might be about status and who's number one. And wars clearly can be fought over status, so I'm not dismissing it. But it is a different type of threat that China poses to the United States. And so can we sustain a coalition in the United States, a domestic politics fear of China, if it's based along those lines? Maybe and maybe not. But it could be misperception. But it's not going to be intentional, meaning I want your land, I'm going to find a pretext to invade you. So yes, we have to worry about misperception or miscalculation. And I can't resist the one thing. I heard a lot about this over and over again. People say, well, I'm just glad I was wrong. You know, I was really worried. I'm very, very worried. I could do this talk. You guys would probably like it a lot better. Or not like, but you would accept it more if I came in and told you why I was so worried. I'm so worried. I'm so worried. This could go wrong. Very, very worried. Power is all that matters. But here's a couple things. You know, I'll give you at the end a ray of hope. Right? Here's what could go wrong. And then, you know what they say 5 years later? I'm just glad I was wrong. And my point is this. Saying, I'm just glad I was wrong, doesn't make you right. You're still wrong. Right? So for 25 years, predicting that China's rise is going to cause an arms race, by now, I'm not going to wait any longer. There's no arms race. There's not going to be a containment coalition. And for the United States, we need to figure out how we're going to deal with a region that shares some but not all of our concerns. So I went on a little bit longer. But anyway, thank you. I look forward to hearing what you have to say. And then we're going to sit over here.
Well, thank you so much for that really interesting talk. And I just wanted to say I'm probably going to disappoint a lot of the audience because I actually happen to agree with not only your conclusions, but most of the argument in between as well. So when I was thinking about today, I was sort of contemplating So first of all, I would say that I am convinced there is no arms race. But how does an arms race matter in the context of Asia? And if it only matters, since it's not happening in East Asia for the United States, how does this last thing that David just said about status, what does that mean for the U.S.? So if China doesn't have imperialistic goals, if it doesn't threaten us economically, what does it mean for the U.S. in terms of its status? I agree that it's not something we need to worry about in 5 years, but perhaps 10, 15? What does it mean for overall U.S. power and status, and what does the U.S. need to do about it, if anything? So if there isn't an arms race, should East Asian countries worry about China? So it's obvious, or at least it seems obvious, that they must not worry so much militarily anyway, if there are those flat lines. So is that something that the U.S. should worry about? Or is this tipping point something that isn't a really useful concept in the context of East Asia? So this idea that if the countries in the region aren't spending, and as the U.S. has sort of disengaged in terms of troops in the region, ships in the region, and it hasn't led to an increase in any of those things for the rest of the East Asian countries, what does that mean for the U.S. in terms of its security umbrella? Does it matter as much as we like to think that it does? And then are we assuming that East Asian countries hence don't perceive China as a threat? Does this military spending aspect actually equate into the states in the region's perspective on China and its threat to them? And then if China is always going to be bigger, as David rightly pointed out, both economically, its population, landmass, military, how does that influence East Asian military spending or prioritization? So we understand what it's looked like for the last 20 years. So should we just all be more worried about it from an economic perspective? So we saw that in the beginning, the chart that showed Japan going, you know, from the 1980s completely down and China completely up. In 1988, the world was concerned about what that economic power meant vis-a-vis Japan. Should we be worried about that vis-a-vis China? Or is worrying, does it even matter if they inherently have such large capacity in all of those areas that I just mentioned? And then looking at Latin America versus East Asia brings to mind, to me anyway, what do Latin American countries see as their biggest threat and what do East Asian countries see as their biggest threat? And are they the same? So obviously Latin America looks very different. There's no large power. Some might claim Brazil is sort of the perhaps the China equivalent, but I would say that's a really, really big stretch. So if Latin America is inherently much more multipolar, does that make those countries just inherently want to spend a bit more because there's a lot more uncertainty in that region? And because their threats are much more internal, transnational criminal groups, the Latin American countries actually have much more use for ships, for lots of those military spending, the things, the big ticket items that people spend on to defend their homeland in a way that East Asian countries, I would argue, just don't nearly have those same sort of challenges. And then I thought the chart on the boats, I think, or the ships was really instructive. And so when we think about arms races, I think we often overlook sea and land and air as three separate components. And so how does an arms race look if it's airframes versus ships versus land? And I would argue in the case of East Asia, sea power arguably matters a lot more. And the forced employment component, which obviously wasn't a portion of this talk, but I think it's something that we should think about vis-a-vis Asia in general. So the U.S. has come up with lots of new concepts in this last 10 years, air-sea battle, the joint operating concept for the global commons. And so in as much as the sheer number of things we spend money on from the U.S. perspective or other countries, the actual weapons, the way that they're used or the concepts in which they would be employed, I think, are equally important. So if there was without those sort of conceptual approaches, I think it's also hard to know what intents are, right? So whenever we look at military spending, what are we actually spending the money on? Are they anti-access aerial denial sorts of things or sort of defensively postured, or are they more offensive capabilities? And so that sort of difference, I think, is an important one. So and along those same lines, does size matter as much as intention? And I think it's hard to know because there's a lot of opaqueness in terms of what China is actually spending its money on. But I think David's given us so many things to think about today. And I think for me, the next step would be, how does this compare with what the U.S. is spending on, you know, the next step, and how does that fit into this conversation? So I totally agree with his findings. East Asia, no arms race. Everybody, peace is breaking out everywhere. We can all be happy and go home. But obviously, the U.S. considers itself a Pacific power. And so what does that mean in this conversation as well? So I'll stop there.
Thanks to both of you. I'd like to give David a few moments to respond to your comments.
Yeah. No, I think those are great. That's very helpful. I didn't focus on the U.S. as much, in part because I'm trying to get the view on the other side. But I clearly think that that's one of the big questions. Because even now, the debate or the discussion in Congress is, what size Navy, as you guys know, what size Navy can the United States sustain over the next generation? And that's driven by these kinds of questions. And from what I understand, most of it is not going to be a 300-ship Navy. It will be something lower than that. And so real choices are going to have to be made by the United States about how to do their Pacific strategy. And I don't want to say that military force is not important, but I think that Obama got it right, and he's got the priorities turned around now, which is it's diplomacy, it's economics, and then it's military. So military is not a non-important. Of course it's important, but I think the other two have not been had enough attention as they could have. So that would be the only clarification, mm-hmm. I would say.
Great. Thank you. Just so you know, for those of you who have friends who could not be here as early birds, we will have this on audio cast eventually. So please encourage people to participate in learning about this important debate. So I'd like to take questions. I'd like to take three at a time, and I'll go around the room. And then please just state your name, your affiliation, and a question, and keep it as brief as possible. And also, if you have a specific person you'd like to address the question to, that would be helpful. I'll start in the back of the room.
Hello, I'm Eric Gomez from the Cato Institute. And I had a question about the issue of allies and non-allies not having spent enough. And the challenge I would raise is that the U.S. has consistently made political promises to defend both allies and non-allies over time. You see, for example, growing interest with Vietnam. I wonder what the response is for us being there for them and encouraging them to not spend as much if they know that we'll have a commitment. And then what happens if we stop doing that? So what happens, for example, if we abrogate a really big commitment such as Taiwan, and if we say we're not going to use direct military force to intervene in the Taiwan Strait anymore? Is that the tipping point? Because we haven't really made that big, really politically important decrease of commitment yet. Thank you.
Thank you for a very good good presentation. Dr. Kang, I wanted to ask you a question. You listed Taiwan as a non-ally. Is that true? I wanted to ask you one other question. You did not list any of the Marines in Darwin among the American troops. You listed, I think, 50?
Okay, no, I can put that in.
And I have one other question for Mrs. Patterson. I'm Elliot Hurwitz, and I used to work at the State Department under Secretary Schultz. You said the U.S. doesn't have imperialistic goals. That was certainly a position. I think you said that, didn't you?
I said if we go ahead.
The treaty with the Philippines in 1947. Was not exactly very fair to them, says David Burley, Michael Burley, a British historian. And FDR was an anti-imperialist, and Churchill was a pro-imperialist. But I think that we have a lot of territories in the Pacific, and have had for 50 or 60 years, and to say that we're non-imperialistic power is a little misleading. Thank you very much.
Okay, what I'd like to do is to give the two okay. a chance to respond, since these are two very related questions, and then we'll move on.
Okay. Sure. Allies versus non-allies. I mean, this is one of the interesting questions about what a commitment is, right? Because if the U.S., in some ways, I think U.S. military presence over piracy, that's a public good that everybody can benefit from. If pirates are deterred because the U.S. is using its navy, everybody in the region benefits. So that's a public good. The question is, at what point do allies or treaty allies in particular, do we make that a private good? Because clearly there's a difference between someone willing to sign a treaty alliance with that specifies what we will and won't do and a vague commitment to another country. And so the question from our side is, how clearly do we want to get involved in guaranteeing something? Because the minute we guarantee it, then there's very – it's called moral hazard, as we all know, right? The question from the Vietnam side is how much they will believe it. Because in Vietnam, for example, the U.S. Navy is limited to one port visit per year in Cam Ranh Bay. The slowdown is not on our side. We've been asking for more port visits. It's the Vietnamese who are holding back. So it's a lot more complex than the Vietnamese sort of saying, great, precisely, I think, for this question. If they start to too easily, you know, get involved with the United States, it's hard to tell what will happen in 5 years. But again, they will have to live with China no matter what. So I think there's a lot of caution on Vietnam's side about appearing to rely on something that I think we all know is inherently not as reliable as it might appear, meaning a U.S., you know, the Vietnamese are not thinking today. They're thinking, okay, if I start to have five port visits and all this stuff with the United States and then it goes away, then what happens to me? So there's a lot – the caution is on the Vietnamese side, not on the U.S. side. And the Taiwan thing, just briefly on that, right? This is the fascinating case study. I put it in the non-ally because we don't have a treaty alliance with it. I mean, that's a whole big brouhaha in the 1970s. It's a really fascinating case, but we don't have the military commitment that we did before then. We don't have the – you know, we have the Shanghai communique and the Taiwan Relations Act. And in many ways, they're precisely, as we all know, they're precisely ambiguous. One says one thing, the other says the other thing. But what they don't do is make the same kind of military commitment to the Philippines. And what I'll point about the Philippines is this. The Philippines cares dramatically about what we call the West Philippine Sea, because we don't call it that. And if we do, they think, their constitutional court thinks that that will mean it comes under the treaty because it's part of Philippine territory. We have not, the United States government has not officially said those territories are Philippine sovereignty, which is what they care about, because the treaty is very clear what we will defend and what we won't defend. So right now, many of those maritime claims that they have, Philippines has in South China Seas, are not covered under the mutual defense treaty as the Philippines and the United States see it. So this is a real question about what an ally means versus just having a presence in the room, in the region.
So in my remarks, what I was referring to is, in David's remarks, he compared China to Russia, sort of explaining why China is not like Russia was during the Cold War, in as much as they aren't demonstrating that they have vast imperialistic goals or expanding its territory, the economic system that they're espousing is not in contradiction to what the U.S. is. And then finally, this idea of status perhaps being the one thing that could be a point of contention between the two. But I wasn't trying to suggest the U.S. was or wasn't imperialistic, although I would say that perhaps my opinion is that in this last 20 years we've tried not to be imperialistic despite our propensity to seemingly involve ourselves in many other countries' disputes, yet with the intent of hopefully not staying forever. So,
thank you. Yes, the two gentlemen in the front here. Why don't you go?
Sure. McDaniel Wicker from the Asia Group. And my question kind of follows on the heels of that imperialistic idea in China. If China isn't imperialistic and there is no arms race, and they have a very strict kind of non-interference policy in the region, what then is the reason for the increased military expenditures there and this vast, you know, modernization in their military efforts?
David Wu, former member of Congress, and this is a question for David Tang. You said that we need to be careful about drawing lessons from European history, and I thought, well, why don't we get a little bit closer to home and draw some, make some analysis from Asian history, and if you look back, 1,000 years, 2,000 years, the little countries, if you will, cut their deal with China and had these suzerain relationships where the smaller countries ran their internal affairs, but China got to run their foreign policy. Could they be cutting that kind of deal for the future, and would that be good for American interests?
We have another question.
Stanley Kober. So far, we're just discussing China. Several years ago, I attended a briefing by defense attaché from the Philippines embassy. There had been a terrorist attack in the Philippines. He said it was Al-Qaeda. I'm now looking at a story from the Philippines dated yesterday. This is a threat from Islamic State. The dark days are coming to you. We will terrorize you even in your sleep. We will kill you and defeat you. This is directed toward the Philippines. Are we looking at the wrong threat?
Yeah. These are great. So on the question of China's military modernization, there's no question, I think, that China feels aggrieved. I mean, and wants to have a modern military that is as good as anybody else's. I think there's no question that that's one of their goals. Partly it's status, partly it's simply power, everything else, right? We also go from an incredibly low base because 3 million men in arms 25 years ago were not in arms because they didn't have enough guns for these people. They're just a bunch of peasants, serfs, really. And so much of this growth, as a percentage of GDP, China's increased military spending is actually going down. It's below 2% as well because they're just growing so rapidly. So much of this is a function of trying to catch up. One of the big questions is, are they defensive or are they offensive with this military? And the thing about a military is, you know, we have all these debates. China's threat, is it worried about things? Is it more internally focused? Is it externally? One of the little phrases that we all know is they spend more on internal defense than internal security than external security. Right. So I think, you know, there's no question that as their military gets stronger, particularly their Navy, they're going to start bumping heads with the United States more. And we need to figure out how we're going to live with them. It isn't, though, the kind of a rapid buildup that they could potentially do. And it's interesting to watch, like, the nuclear forces and the kinds of things they could proliferate or expand that seem to be going at a slower pace than not. But this is, I think, riding a tiger. There's a whole bunch of things about my basic point is I think there's an inevitable modernization that China is going through in its military as everything else. And it doesn't appear to be unusually different than the rest of the modernization of, say, the bureaucracies and everything else. The Asian history and then ISIS. I think these are really interesting. I think there's so much in Asian history that we tend not to pay attention to, and we just simply know Europe. And this is a subject for another lecture, a little more of an egghead lecture, but it's worthwhile because nobody knows anything about East Asian history, right? And I'll give you one example, which is probably the largest war in the world in history at that time was the Japanese invasion of Korea in 1592. And it was on a scale 10 times what Europe could have. 200,000 troops on 1,000 boats went across water, something that the Spanish Armada had 28,000 troops on 130 ships. The scale of what these countries could do historically dwarfed anything Europe could do. But they chose to relate with each other differently. And I think that's the optimistic side of looking at East Asian history, which is this. We are not inevitably, life is not, as Hobbes said, nasty, brutish, and short. There's many different ways that we can construct relations with each other. And the European experience is only one way. And there's other ways in which we can do it. I don't know whether that will come to pass or not. But the world is much wider, and the universe of possibility is much wider than we think that every country is out. It's inevitably a game of risk, and you just have to push each other around. The last thing on ISIS is this is exactly one of the reasons that I think if you actually go, and I wrote a book about the Philippines. I've spent a lot of time there. And, yeah, they don't want China pushing them around. Nobody wants a bully. But of their threats, the Philippine military still is overwhelmingly internally focused, precisely because that's where the real instability lies, is with Mindanao and these unresolved tensions that go back hundreds of years. And that's where the military is really focused. The other things are secondary.
Becca, you want to add?
Yeah, I want to follow up on the ISIS point. I can't let it go. So I think...
Yeah, I don't know whether it's ISIS or not,
yeah,
but Mindanao.
No, but,
know,
but
yeah.
Taking it back to the U.S. a bit, I mean, I think... The U.S. military that has a strong incentive and sort of its favorite thing to do is prepare for conventional warfare, right? And so we look at both the most dangerous and the most likely threats. And so at the same time, the U.S. has had this notional pivot to Asia. As you see, the numbers don't really bear fruit on that argument from a military perspective. But the most likely threat right now is ISIS, and the U.S. is heavily involved in that all over the world, to include the Philippines. And I think we've seen a rise in trying to train other countries' militaries to do this themselves. So having a significant number of senior military officers come here for school to try to improve the indigenous capacity to fight terrorism. But I think a lot of this comes down to government legitimacy as well. And so you see this all over the world in places where the government can't quite exert its power over its entire country. So thanks for the great question.
Thank you. If I may, I'd like to pose a question focused on Korea and Japan, because David had shown us the slide about the two countries that actually have a sense of real threat, North Korea and Taiwan.
Yeah.
And then you also talked about the perceptions of threat, military threats coming out of Korea vis-a-vis Japan, China vis-a-vis Japan. And I want to add this bit of information to complicate matters even more. There's a difference between a perception of military threat that the public sees versus that military assessors would see. There's a difference between a perception of militarism and a perception or understanding of what a military buildup is. And I think we often, whether we are experts, media, academics, lay people reading the paper, we conflate them or mix them up regularly. And I think it's very important to disaggregate them, not conflate them, because they can be very misleading depending on which figures one uses. The East Asia Institute, a think tank in Seoul, Korea, came out with a pretty recent survey that they did with a Japanese counterpart group, surveying the Korean and Japanese public about mutual perceptions of the bilateral Japan-Korea relationship. And I found this part very interesting. When Koreans were asked what is hindering the Japan-Korea relationship in terms of improving the relationship, about 57% of the Korean public reported last spring that that Japan's militarism is hindering the development of bilateral relations. But, strangely, only 7.6% of Koreans said the reason for the difficulty in improving bilateral relations is the Japanese military buildup. So even Koreans differentiate between a perception of militarism, which is more psychological, political, and an actual military buildup, which is tangible, right? And I think it's very important to keep these factors or signifiers separate and to be very careful how we describe militarism, militarization, military buildup, arms race. Japan is one of the least militarized societies in the world, both by military capacity in terms of infrastructure, as well as a societal willingness to make warmongering a normal part of life. South Korea is one of the most militarized societies in the world in terms of its military capacity, infrastructure, and a societal mindset that going to war is part of a normal part of life. And I think this needs to be emphasized over and over because South Korea continues to see Japan as militaristic, and yet the actual militarization exists in South Korea, much less so in Japan.
Yeah, good point.
questions, comments. Yes. You have a microphone here. Your name, please?
Yang Ro-yoon, Foundation for Empowerment. First of all, I'd like to thank the Professor Kang. David, thank you very much for the actual presentation, which is so entertaining and instructive. At the same time, I'm really impressed with your presentation, which looks at the perspectives of the East Asians and others. As a person, as an economist who used to work for the World Bank for 20 years, now that kind of thing is that sensitivity as an maybe anthropologist is really great. Thank you very much for that. And I have the one comment on the Professor Moon's the information now, and I have just one question, wacky question. First of all, I think that as a Korean, I feel that the reason why Korean public might have differentiated between the militarism and the military buildup. Many Koreans, including me and the other friends of mine, think that, yes, Japan is not spending that much money on military base. But on the other hand, we are always aware that if they are willing, and their capacity is enormous because of the technological advance or something like that. So the as a Koreans who have certainly a lot of grudge, they are justified and unjustified about Japan. So that's why they can have that kind of the response. And I think, actually, your information really makes me feel good. You know, Koreans can differentiate that kind of thing. That really confirms my sort of like positive attitude and positive view that, you know, Japan and Korea, we can get along in the future even better. And my question is rather wacky. So first of all, I mean, I think that some people talked about East Asian history and all these things. But if we go back, you know, like China has not been always China like today. China of today is, to me, is the largest, and one of the most it's the largest actual territory, and it's almost like Tang Dynasty. Since Tang Dynasty or Yuan Dynasty, it's not like as large as Yuan Dynasty, but it's one of the largest, and it's coming up. So China has been going through fluctuations. So my question is that, you know, like not to be wrong, in 10 years. David, what do you think about the stability of the China as China now? Because now China as a communist can do this. And while I and other economists and the international experts think that and hope that the strong middle class in the China would help the facilitate regime change into the democracy. Would it be that smooth? You know, so if that's the case, then as a corollary, as you have and others have discussed, the military build-up, military spending, it relates to the internal thing as well. So if the now, for example, China going through difficulty in economics and things like that, then the China may spend more money on military to really satisfy.
Your question's about the future.
That's right.
To
appease
change.
Their own people. Okay. So, like, okay. I'd like to ask those questions to both of you.
I have one more question, and we have some young people in the audience here who I know are actively studying these issues. So, yes.
I promise to try to keep it very short. My name is Harjop. I do geopolitics, Europe and Asia Pacific. Found it very fascinating, your study on whether there's an arms race or not in East Asia. However, I just wanted to know that did you take into consideration how various countries, for example, China, and then if we go outside of East Asia, India, are trying to develop their own native military infrastructure, their own military weapons. There's even news now, for example, that Vietnam is giving docking rights to India. They're going to be buying military assets from India. Same thing with Australia. Australia potentially might be buying submarines, advanced submarines from Japan. So I'm just curious, how do you equate that? How do you incorporate that into consideration of, okay, if we're not an arms race right now, could we potentially be an arms race 5-10 years from now?
Okay. No, these are great. Thank you. You know, a couple things, and it is worth, again, when we think about East Asia, the last time the Chinese military fired any shots was 1988. The last time the Japanese military fired any shots, 1945. That's a long time, which to the past doesn't, you know, that was then, this is now. That's a long time if we think about, as Rebecca said, a sort of willingness, or as Kathy was talking about, willingness to use force is the first one. These countries, actually, their evidence is they're very, you know, they don't start shooting right away. They don't have a lot of things to start shooting about right away. I'll just talk briefly about Chinese stability, because that's obviously the big question. What I always point out when people say what will happen to China, will it collapse, will it implode, will it become a democracy, is that going back to my little hobby horse, it'll probably not look anything like we expect it to. When people say, will China become a democracy, it's not clear what they think in their minds, but it's not going to look like Ohio, you know, whatever. You know, it's not going to be small town farmers, you know, joining the Rotary Club and voting or something like that, right? If it does become a democracy, it'll look probably like a Korea or a Japan, right? It can be a mixed authoritarian. My best guess is it'll be a mixed authoritarian regime like Singapore or Malaysia for decades. Right, I think, you know, the idea that a middle class ineluctably leads again to Kansas is whatever, you know, it's like not the case, right? It's going to be Chinese. If it collapses, it's not going to break into the, you know, here's where history does matter and Asian history matters. 1914 is not coming back to East Asia. But the 1914 I'm talking about is Asian 19. Here's what happened 100 years ago. China was the end of the Qing Dynasty. It was a decaying, falling apart country that was – Japan was this rapidly rising industrial power with a lot of fears about colonization and imperialism. The Western powers from Japan, United States, Germany were literally conquering and colonizing every part of East Asia that they could get their hands on. In that context, Japan decided its best response was to start invading everybody else. And China broke into a bunch of warlord regimes. That's not happening. That world does not exist anymore. China is now a huge major power. Japan has no chance that they're going to start trying to invade. So no matter what, and Western powers are not going to try and do things. So the point is China can have a lot of problems. But I can't imagine a situation under which, when we think of economic problems, that it's just going to fall apart and we'll be back to the warlords of the 1920s. I don't see how that's going to happen. The situation then was about as stark as you can imagine. A weak, decaying China with a power vacuum in the region. That's not there anymore. So I don't see that happening at all. So on both extremes. And the brief thing about India and Japan and arms buying arms and things is what I see interesting about that is an attempt in many ways to diversify away from the United States. And I don't think it's arms racing, but countries buy, you know, Australia goes back and forth on whether they're going to do 6 submarines or not and whether it's worth it. And they constantly go back, and at first it was Korean, and then it was Japan, right? I think, and Korea, I think, is deciding on a fighter, and I think they chose a not U.S. I haven't paid that much attention to it because it's all this.
They developed their own.
Yeah, right? I mean, I think it's an attempt to diversify away from having to buy the platforms from the United States. But that's a whole different question of the whole global arms trade, which I think is a different question than the one I'm talking about.
We'll take a final round of questions, comments, and then we will close. We have a question here.
Thank you very much. Blake Phillips, I'm just a student. So I guess I had 2 quick questions. One, I guess I was just wondering if there's any other countries that we need to take into account in East Asia, either like Greek or Russia or the European Union or India, and kind of within the economic, military, and just kind of geopolitical structure. And also how much does trade and trade routes. So that's something that the United States talks about, is ensuring the freedom of the navigation, freedom of seas. And so I don't know if that's – I have a hard time believing – I'm just kind of trying to figure out what that actually means. And is there actually a real concern that China would actually have cut off trade routes, or is that just more of just like having the power to do so is the important part? Thank you.
Great.
Any final question out there? Yes. Paul, right behind you.
Thank you. Linnea Logi, intern at the Stimson Center. And I was just wondering if the lack of sort of a measurable buildup in arms is less so evidence of a lack of desire to have kind of an increased defensive capability as it is kind of the priority that's placed on economic ties with China and maintaining good business relations, and also economic constraints within each of these countries domestically and demographic issues going forward.
Okay, sure. Good. These are great. No, the other countries, and it goes back to, the question about India, right, which is this. In many ways, these countries, like right now we're talking about Africa and China in Africa, China in Latin America. One of my good friends does Latin America and is – all her research is on Chinese investment, right? So these are now global countries. In some ways they matter. In other ways, though, when you think about, for example, South China Sea, North Korea issue, Taiwan, these countries aren't the central ones that are really going to – they're, you know, they may have an opinion, but they're not – none of the countries, India or Russia maybe on North Korea matters, or on a maritime dispute with Japan, right? But aside from that, they're not really the centrally ones. So that's why I'm sort of restricting the scope of what I'm interested in to these countries, right? And the trade question goes also to the question from the lady from the Stimson Center, which is, I don't know what China wants with the islands, but it is unlikely that they're going to set up a set of barriers and start charging tolls for boats. I mean, that's not happening, right? And so in many ways, and this is why it will be hard, I think, there are D.C. people who care about freedom of navigation and stuff, but it's a different issue than are they really going to do this, right? Are they really going to try and cut off trade and everything else? I mean, I can't fathom how that's going to happen. And it goes to the question of whether it's economic ties that are reducing it. I don't want to say that the stale debate in school is real, balance of power versus economic interdependence. Well, if you trade, then you won't want to fight. But if you're too big, you get scared and you fight. And I see it differently, right? Which is the economic ties aren't the interdependence per se, but they help to raise the cost of a war, right? I mean, if you think about it, all these countries are so deeply intertied with each other economically that their focus isn't on fighting. If they were worried about actual national survival, all these countries, I think, overnight would. And that's what a Vietnam does. I mean, if China wanted to invade Vietnam, they would drop everything and start fighting again. But when national survival is pretty clearly not threatened, the focus of these countries, and the reason that actually, when I'm teaching classes or whatever I say, the reason we care about East Asia over the last 50 years is not war. It's trade, right? We have Samsung phones and Hyundai cars and
hey, you have
I have an iPhone. That's right. USA.
iPhone.
No, but we have Honda and blah, 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 right? I mean, the reason that this region is vibrant over the last 50 years is what's happened in the economy. And that's what these countries are focused on. When their national leaders wake up in the morning, they're not worried necessarily. I mean, war might be one of them, but that's not the thing they think about most. And so the focus is on building these other institutions. And as I said, I think to some ways this was a security talk, and so I should probably start talking more about the economics as well, because the countries in the region are building regional ties and institutions in parallel with TPP and everything else. They don't intend to let – if TPP fails, they've got a bunch of other stuff there just in case. And they're having parallel ones. They're happy to have both. They are building out a regional relationship, set of regional relationships with each other, in which we are important, but we're not the only one. So I think that's how it plays into both of these, which is not necessarily economic interdependence per se, but what they really are focused on and what their leaders care about and prioritize.
Yes, Rebecca.
So I just want to say a couple of things about some of the past questions. So I think if there's one theme that I've heard come up over and over, it's this history matters, both in terms of the intents of the actors in the region. But I think Kathy's point on Korea and Japan is a really interesting one, because when you look at the troop numbers that David had on the slide, 30,000 plus in both South Korea and Japan, and the other side, which showed the flat lines for all the East Asian countries except for South Korea, which has a slight increase, which should be no surprise since they are the ones who have the biggest threat on their border. But in addition, with the continued U.S. presence for the last 50 years, there's a lot of purchases just because of interoperability with the U.S. But I think in over time, it will be really interesting to see if South Korea does decide to diversify and purchase more arms from other countries. And that might be a really interesting indicator of a change in motivation with respect to Korea. And the other thing I wanted to mention in terms of Chinese, their military in general, just as a note that they're like the third or fourth largest peacekeeping contributor and actually just recently decided to double the number of troops that they're contributing to peacekeeping. So in as much as status matters and sort of a worldwide presence for militaries, I think that's also an interesting indicator of perhaps wanting to be more involved in the world and not just in the economic sphere. And then finally, in the sort of economic interdependence for, you know, as a prevention of war, just as a totally outside of Asia vignette, in the Georgia-Russian war in early 2000, the Georgians made a concerted effort to continue economic relations even after the war started. So this sort of either or, I think, is sort of a false dichotomy in today's world. And I think that's it. My random comments.
Well, I am just thrilled at having learned so much. So thanks to both of you for such an excellent job, and particularly today for flying out from California last night and then flying back right after this panel. And thanks to all of you. Thanks to our staff members who have made the event possible. And we will look forward to seeing you again soon at Brookings. Thank you.